Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 159, Super Knowledge for Busy People.
I've been following your progress with all of your postings, and now we're getting down to hardball. So you might see why we spent so much effort preparing to read this stuff. It's really not easy, right? And of course, one thing that some of you maybe remember, because we've been reading so much in the OR, which the last bit on karma got everybody all tangled up, and me too. And then I looked at some of the Tibetan of it, and I think he was in a rush in that chapter. It's a little more messed up than some of his other chapters. But the word indestructible is not correct. Indestructible just means that chumasa means that a particular karmic act or evolutionary act doesn't lose its effect. So chumasa means it's not wasted. Its effect doesn't get wasted. Doesn't get lost. And indestructible is absolutely not what Chumisawa translates, etc. So, because you guys are all balling stuff about the indestructible. There is such a thing in Tantra as the indestructible drop in the heart center, which is like considered to be like the what they call the wind mind, indivisible, the locus of the subtle body mind that travels from previous life in the dreamlike between state. It's called the indestructible drop, among other things. It's a subtle continuum, like the continuum of a gene or something like that. Sometimes they call it the spiritual gene. So it's like a super subtle energy pattern that carries the code of one's previous actions from life to life. And during a particular life, it resides in the center of the heart chakra. But it's always changing, And it's Tantra, so it's esoteric. It's maintained as esoteric precisely because, of course, people would latch onto it as a soul, as a fixed soul, because we have such a strong sense of having a fixed point of existence about ourselves, that we would attach to that. That's why it's maintained. It's sort of an esoteric thing, what's called the indestructible drop. But the chumisawa, inevitability, in a way you could say, the inevitability of a karmic action giving its effect. And chumisawa would be better as inevitable. It's inevitable rather than indestructible. Something, because it's emphasizing that it will eventually give its effect. And it's one of the mysteries. Now, karma in general, this is preliminary to tackling the real meat of the day, but anyway, karma in general is considered, there's three types of objects of knowledge in Buddhist logic. The directly perceptible object of knowledge, perceived by sense faculties, of which mind sense is concluded as a sense faculty, and the mind therefore encounters a mental image internally as a direct perception, CAD, in other words. And then there's inferential objects, which are called obscured objects, which you can understand by inference, like you see smoke on a hilltop as you're walking in the woods, coming off somewhere far away, and then you realize there's a fire in a clearing there. So you're perceiving the fire indirectly. It's obscured from your sight. All you can see is the smoke. But by inference, knowing that where there's smoke, there's fire, you then understand the presence of the fire. And then there's what's called extremely obscured. And extremely obscured is not necessarily achievable by inference, but must be the only way of knowing about something that's extremely obscured is by reliable testimony. That's the third kind of object. And karma, and the workings of karma, not the presence or actuality of karma, the actuality of causality, But the workings of karmic causality, of evolutionary causality, is considered extremely obscured. And therefore, in a way, unless we have... Now, the extremely obscured and the obscured, however, of course, can become directly understandable. If you attain one of the super knowledges, for example, which means knowledge of previous lives, for example, then one of the Buddha knowledges, then you can directly perceive the experience of the existence of a previous life of your own, supposedly. Just like when you get to the clearing, you can then see the fire, that before you only inferred being there by seeing the smoke. So that doesn't mean it's always, you know, inscrutable or extremely obscured. But normally, to a normal person, then it's obscured, and we have to rely on testimony, reliable testimony. So that's why karma is kind of presented like that as a mystery. However, there's various other countervailing factors about it. As we have gotten, we haven't quite gotten there, except, well, we did an introduction, but we haven't gotten there in Dzongkhapa's own text. But due to his hermeneutic of the Prasangikas, which he is, which is not the hermeneutic that we're reading it today. This is the Vijnanavada one, which he is setting up and arguing for, but he eventually intends to refute. This is, in a way, what they call a purva paksha, a prior antagonist position that he's outlining. And as I think I've mentioned before, in Indian and Tibetan philosophy, the greatness of a philosopher has to do with how well they can outline the opponent's position and really actually adopt that position, in fact, while they're arguing it, and then switch around and reject it. Do you know what I mean? So real critical thought is like that, where you can really empathize with the opponent's view, particularly for the Prasangikas, who have no view of their own in a certain way, no dogmatic view of their own. And therefore, they appreciate everyone's view, even the absolutists or the nihilists. In one of his talks, the Dalai Lama was making a big point about how in Indian history, philosophical history, the materialist called Charvaka, who didn't believe in former and future life, didn't believe in the mind as apart from the brain or the body, and thought you should just live for pleasure in this life and enjoy whatever you can get away with. And because when you die, it's all over, and that's all, there's no consequence, which is the modern view. But he said that the teachers of that tradition in India, although everybody deplored that idea and that philosophy, the teachers of it were respected, and they were called rishis. Rishi means like a sage, you know. And he was making a big point out of that, that even the secularist, who, which is the worst view from the point of view of both Buddhists, Hindus, and Jains, is still respected in the Indian tradition. It's like the secularist, you know, humanist secularist. Like when the Dalai Lama met Carl Sagan, and Sagan asked him if he would, what he would do if Sagan could disprove future life. I told you this story already? I did. I won't tell you. Okay, so that's the thing about karma. So don't worry too much about it. Of course, and of course, by the way, oh yeah, and the hermeneutic is that all descriptions of relative processes are not absolute. They are interpretable in meaning, which means they're only relatively true. But that's true enough, of course, to be true. You know, relative truth, you know, like this bottle, that there's something water fluid that you could drink that's all right, that isn't damaging too much to health. That's a relative truth, but that is true. That it's not poison is true. If it was a bottle of poison, then I shouldn't drink it. It's importantly relatively true. But still, all such descriptions are only relatively true. So the exact workings of karma, whether one is born this way or that way, whatever, are somehow best hypothesis at the moment, so to speak. Although the Buddhists will stick to it pretty hard. But it's, nevertheless, it's not an absolute dogma. But it's the most reasonable hypothesis, backed up by the most reliable testimony, you could say. But however, not an absolute. That's why Buddhism, in its descriptions of relative realities, meets Western science with its idea that all laws of nature and all scientific theories are hypotheses accounting for the evidence as best they can, but awaiting falsification by further evidence. And therefore, always open to be re-described, always open to be re-theorized, if you follow me. Which is, you know, the proper falsifiability idea, you know, which I think is very good about science. Like, you know, Einstein rejected the existence of the ether, you know, and then he made big relativism or relativity breakthroughs. Okay? So that's one thing. And then the second thing is that there's always this funny point here where since Buddha, and therefore all descriptions of relative reality, if they're really pushed at them with full critical thing, they will dissolve under analysis. For example, Since we and the Buddha have had infinite previous lives, and there would be a beginningless universe, in a series of beginningless universes, you know, many different universes that began and ended, but the overall series of them is beginningless, then we have all accumulated an infinite amount of negative karma, and so has Buddha. And also positive karma we've accumulated. And yet we're sort of here at the moment, you know, suffering the effects or enjoying the effects of past recent negative and positive karmas. But to become perfectly enlightened, where we no longer have any suffering, therefore, in some sense, we have to break the inevitability of karmic effects. Because to become enlightened, the Buddha would have had to experience an infinite negative karma, in a way. Or to eliminate or to burn out an infinite store of negative karma, and that would have taken an infinite amount of time. So in other words, enlightenment would be impossible, nirvana would be impossible, if karma really was indestructible, as he wrongly translated that. Jumisawa, which means inevitable. You know, it means that if you do something, you'll get an effect. As in staying in the plane of being an ordinary person, tied up in the ordinary web of cause and effect. But they're somehow loose. Now, in this light, we didn't read in this class, I think, Karl Potter's chapter in his Presuppositions of Indian Philosophy, which I usually get people to look at. His chapter on causation, which is a very good chapter. Karl with the K, Potter, Presuppositions of Indian Philosophy. And he has in there a table, which is just the one page, and even is wonderful. And in that table, he has a scale of the different Indian philosophical systems' views of causation. And that scale runs from the fatalist, who therefore, for him, causation is absolutely inevitable. And the famous fatalist teacher used to do a trick when he would give a philosophical lecture. And he would carry with him a ball of twine. And at the high moment of his lecture, he would take the ball of twine and throw it while holding one end. And then the ball of twine would unravel, and then when it reached its end, the ball unraveled fully, the thread would fall to the ground. So this was his illustration that you no need to seek nirvana, to seek release or liberation or whatever, because he was one of the ascetic teachers, because your karma will wear itself out and then you'll be enlightened. You know, you'll see nirvana or moksha. He wasn't a Buddhist, but achieve moksha sooner or later. So that's where cause and effect are so rigidly connected, and yet, of course, he made out of it that eventually it stops. But still, that there's nothing you can do to affect. You're like predestined, you know. You're just totally caught in a robot piece, in a piece of thing. Then on the other extreme is the Charvaka, who is like the modern random mutation materialist. And so the spontaneous Big Bang out of no reason, the moment in no time, in no place, created in all time and place, supposedly. That's the Charvaka, the materialist, who doesn't believe in the spirit or mind or any form of future life, or even the coherence of causality. If it seems coherent in a small range, that you plant the seed and that grows, that just happened by accident, and it might not happen the next time, type thing. That's why he's said to have a good time. I mean, he doesn't know what will happen. But he looks forward to being obliterated anyway, so in case it's something really bad. So those are the two extremes. In other words, causation is too loose and causation is too tight. And then he ranges all the different views in between. And the Buddhist views, although there are different Buddhist views in the different levels of the, you know, the hierarchy of different Buddhist theories, which we've had a taste of, they're sort of near the middle, which is why they kind of last. Because their way of explaining karmic or evolutionary causation is neither too tight nor too loose. So it's not absolutely fatalistically determined, nor is it completely random and unreliable. It's kind of like in the middle. And then there are various other ones that are, you know, that then the other theories, he ranges them. You can see it's quite detailed. And he breaks down within Vedanta several different types of views, within Buddhism different types of views. Really excellent. Karl Potter, grand old man of Indian philosophy, and also including Buddhist philosophy. Okay, so that's all about karma. A lot of you were kind of all bollocked up about karma. The other thing I want to say about karma, yes, one of you talked about, is that you say that, you know, you're kind of bummed out, talking about being so rigorous and logical and all this in the OR, it seems, and then suddenly he's talking like karma and people doing miracles. It's all like, he uses it as an example as if that was sort of normal. But the miracle business is normal in that culture that he's writing for. Nobody thinks it's extraordinary. As I said about the Milarepa story, when Milarepa had become a great siddha, a yogi with sort of powers, he flew over his home area once when he was levitating, flying somewhere from one mountain cave to another, and his a nephew of his saw him going, or a cousin of his, and shouted to his father, like, "Oh, look, Milarepa must be a great yogi now. Like, he's flying through the sky." And then the uncle, who hated Milarepa, said, "Where is he? Give him my bow and arrow. I'm going to shoot him down." So, like, it's, you know, he wasn't amazed or respectful even that he was flying. It was, you know, these things are considered normal in that culture. I know they are considered like really weird in our culture. And that is categorical different. That's categorically different from the former future life thing. Now, former future life thing is not considered in Buddhism something that you need faith about. Former future life is considered common sense. And, you know, you don't have to encounter siddha about it. And in their view, therefore, and, you know, the burden of proof would be on anybody who would say that there would be a radical discontinuity of something becoming nothing. You know, something like a law of conservation of psychic as well as physical energy, you could say, which that just means subtle energy and coarse energy. So for them, that's a common sense thing, and therefore they refer to that as if it's not necessary to prove it. And I had one friend, Lama, who taught at Amherst College with me once, and he was challenged by people like, "I have a problem with that. How can you prove it?" He refused to discuss it. He said, "I don't try to argue with anybody about former future life. If you want to know about it, just read the newspaper." Because he was in India, you know, there's so many stories of some little girl was born someplace, and soon she talks, she says, "I have to go back to my village," which is in a different province, like a month's salary worth of a bus ride away. And eventually she's so buggy to the family, they take her back to this other town far away, like from Tamil Nadu, going to Madhya Pradesh or something, or Orissa. And when she gets there, she runs down some mud hut lanes, and she runs into a particular house compound, and she greets everybody by name in that house compound, some village, and then she orders them to dig in an adobe wall in a little back dingy room, and they dig in there, and they find a little pot with like 5,000 rupees that she had saved there from her previous life at the granny and died without being able to tell the family she'd been saving this 5,000 rupees. So she didn't get any award. It's India. It's not considered that weird or normal. There's like tons of documented stories like that that often get published in the newspapers, but they don't get anything out of it. In fact, the poor family, I'm sure, didn't get repaid for the bus tickets by the people who got the 5,000 rupees, which was granny's former relatives. Although there is one case, Dalai Lama mentioned it again the other day in his talk with the Indian people in Delhi, which he personally, he drove down and he investigated all the families. There's one girl who was killed by a bus in a young age and then reborn in the neighborhood near where she was killed in a poorer family. But then when she was speaking, she was insisting that she was the daughter of such and such a family and apparently passed whatever test of recognizing people and so on across town in the better part of town. So ended up having four parents, actually. And going to a better school. And became like a little bit of a celebrity in her little town, you know, when she was about five, six, seven. So she would go back and forth between the two families. And Dalai Lama really liked that one. He offered to help her with a scholarship when she gets to college age, if she studies hard. Okay, so now we're coming to the Tsongkhapa thing, and you all found it really a pain in the neck. And I don't blame you. And it is, but what he's doing is he's setting up the Vijnanavada or the consciousness, the idealistic school, consciousness only school view of the issue of hermeneutics, the issue of what is interpretable and what is definitive in the Buddha's teachings. And in order to do that, because that is a major source. Has an important hermeneutic. This sutra, especially the sutra called the Samdhinirmochana Sutra, the Elucidation of Intention Scripture, which is used by the great scholar and saint Asanga basing a lot of his theories on. And it gives the three wheels of Dharma theory, which you have read, and most of you, that was not the difficult part. And most of you read that, where it says that Buddha taught first the wheel as if everything exists. That is the dualistic form of Buddhism. You know, the Four Noble Truths, suffering exists, samsara exists, also nirvana really exists, and you can get out of samsara really and get to nirvana. And he didn't get into the issue much of the intrinsic realitylessness of samsara and nirvana, both for that matter, and everything. He just is into like, do this and understand it, and then mainly he only emphasizes personal selflessness, which is which uproots the ignorance that is the cause of suffering. And then you achieve nirvana, right? So that's the first wheel. Let's consider it the first wheel. And that's interpretable, but it's useful for a certain type of person. And it was his first thing that he taught. It's like the base foundational teaching. The second wheel was then the opposite in a way, where it's all prajnaparamita, which is everything is void, void, void. Negation, 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 no, no, no. You know, lack of intrinsic reality, absence of intrinsic reality, emptiness, etc. And also adds to the subjective selflessness of the person, objective selflessness of things. I call it, in these translations, phenomenal selflessness, as well as in parallel with personal selflessness. Nowadays I translate those two as subjective and objective selflessness. Okay? And then the third wheel of Dharma is the Samdhinirmochana Sutra itself, and some other associated sutras. And there they claim to be making it more sophisticated. It's not all thumbs up and not all thumbs down. It's thumbs up on some things and thumbs down on some things. And here, the chart on page, I think, 118, I look back on it, because you did read through it, but you didn't really remember it when you were struggling with this. But this little table here on page 118, where you see that the centrist view of Nagarjuna, and which we've been sort of mostly looking at, in the introduction and in the OR, you know, in the Nagarjuna's work, you have basically two realities: superficial conventional reality, relative reality, and then profound ultimate reality. You know, the opposite of superficial being profound, and then the opposite of conventional being ultimate. And ending up in the non-duality of those two is sort of the Madhyamaka thing. But the Vijnanavada people, the third wheel of Dharma, feels that people who only have those two, and especially when they collide with the no shunyata business, you know, and when they then say that, well, all relative things are illusory, they're like illusions, and, you know, they're not, David corrected one of you very nicely in the interim, so he said, they're not illusions, but they are illusory, they're like illusions, you know, the relative world. But they're not absolutely an illusion, that is, they're totally unreal. They're just like an illusion, because they're kind of dreamlike. Like a dream, like a dream is real, but it's illusory compared to waking. And so when the ultimate or actuality of things is no, and then the only way they exist is on some superficial level, people will become nihilistic. The Buddha worries. So he teaches this thing. He breaks down the two realities into three realities, basically. And you see here, he adds, he expands the razor's edge of the conceptual line between the relative and the absolute into what he calls the relative nature or the relative reality, which then seems to be the pivot, you know, the fulcrum over which, you know, the unreal world of samsara versus the real world of freedom and liberation and bliss are turned on that fulcrum, you see. So then I make a little Y there, you see, and then you have the relative nature in between, because he feels that then people have a feeling that, well, that relative is really there, and it's just overlaid and defiled by the imagined or constructed, and then when it's cleansed, it is the perfect. It's cleansed of that imagined and constructed. Okay, and so that's what this is about. So the first question, the inquiry, is, you know, well, you know, the Divine Lord, Buddha, the Bhagavan, Paramartha Samudgata. Samudgata means, his name is even kind of fun in the elucidation intention. It means one who transcends via ultimate truth, Paramartha Samudgata. Or, you know, he's gone thoroughly outward or transcendent based on Paramartha. And Paramartha means the supreme meaning, that is to say, the ultimate. So he says, well, you talk about you know, you have said in the past and mentioned things as if they had intrinsic identity. And here I make a note about that, which we will come back to again and again about intrinsic identity, but which you read on note one there. But I'm not going to elaborate just now, because I'm just focusing on the question. So in other words, you talk about things, in other words, as if they really are really there. You talk about suffering, you talk about ignorance, you talk about addictions and their consequences and karma and its consequences. And then later you come and you say, well, you also proclaim intrinsic unreality, non-production, non-sensation, primordial peace and natural total liberation of all things. That is to say, naturally, this is nirvana, you say. So what's going on with this? Where is it at? Why are you doing that? He says. So then the Buddha does this fine discrimination business. And the fine discrimination business is, he says, well, when I said intrinsic unreality, I didn't mean everything is unreal. I meant there were three types of such unreality: identity unreality, production unreality, and ultimate unreality, which correspond, of course, to the imagined, the relative, and the perfect, or relative and absolute, right?
This podcast was originally recorded at Columbia University. To listen to the full unedited archive recordings, please visit archive.org or bobthurman.com. This episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast is a part of the Buddhism 101 series, using classic teachings from Robert Thurman to elucidate basic concepts of the tradition. To learn more, please visit bobthurman.com. To watch special video editions of classic episodes of the Bob Thurman Podcast, please visit the Tibet House US YouTube channel. And now back to Bob with the second half of this week's podcast.
To do is, I want to now step back, and something that you didn't read and I didn't assign, but it's quite a fine thing, and I recommend it to one of you who's doing a paper, is the great Buddhist logicians who are disciples of Vasubandhu. They start, Dignaga, the first one of them, is a disciple of the brother of Asanga Vasubandhu, who you run into in this Vijnanavada school. And he's a disciple of, and then his guy called Dignaga. And Dignaga was a great logician and a Buddhist philosopher. And he kind of bridges between the sort of most sophisticated of the realist Buddhist schools, the Sautrantikas, and the Vijnanavadins, the first Mahayana school, the idealist Mahayana school. And then his great disciple was Dharmakirti, who was a South Indian guy who has a lot of colorful stories about him. He's a big, great debater, famous debater. And then his thing called Nyayabindu, the drop of reason, or drop, what does he call it, drop of logic? What is here about? And this is a Russian translation from a long time ago. Short treatise of logic, he called it. But literally, Nyayabindu, bindu means like a drop or a seed, and Nyaya means reasoning, or it can be logic. And his first statement is, all successful human action is preceded by right knowledge. Therefore, this knowledge will be investigated. And this is pramana. He uses the word pramana. I translate pramana as validating cognition or validating knowledge, because it means the knowledge that it's not really just that it's right, it's that it validates your experience. You know, and then, so he begins with that. And then he says, so now we're investigating, validating cognition, as I would rather translate. Then the second statement is, in the root text, is that validating cognition or right knowledge is twofold, direct and indirect. And here he's following Dignaga. And then, and these are the two things, two objects of knowledge, you know, the evident and the obscure. So that means that pratyaksha, your sense experience, your intuition in a Kantian sense, unmediated knowing of something, direct intuition of it, and the Kantian use of intuition, through the six senses, the five senses that see, hear, taste, touch, smell, and the sixth one, which is the mental sense, which perceives an inner mental object, and also has to align itself with a sense perception, like when you see this, in order to register that kind of in your mind, the mental sense has to align itself with the visual sense. And then that's why when you're looking at the color green of the book, you're not paying attention to some sound or, you know, how the chair feels on your back or some other, you know, one another. You're picking out one sense from another sense, right? And so that's direct, he calls perception. I think intuition is actually better. Okay, so I'm just following his framework. I'm sorry, I'm quibbling with his words. So we have intuitive knowledge, and then the other one, indirect, is inferential knowledge, which involves verbal. So construction or judgment, then he goes to the second type. Construction or judgment based on inference implies a distinct cognition of a mental reflex, which is capable of coalescing with the verbal designation. These are, you know, it's a root text, so it's logic stuff, so it's really, it sounds technical. But the key point is that then, what I'm coming to is, he then aligns. He says, knowledge exempt from such mental construction, when it is not affected by an illusion produced by color blindness, rapid motion, traveling on board a ship, sickness, or other causes, is perceptive knowledge, or intuitive knowledge, I would say. And then he goes on differentiating the different types of knowledge. My main point is, I don't really need that. My main point is this. He does the brilliant thing where the only thing we can really rely on is our direct sense experience. And the object that we encounter with intuitive direct sense experience is the ultimate reality, actually. So when I see the wall, that experience of perceiving the wall is an actual ultimate reality. It doesn't disappear. It's real. However, it is unverbalizable. It is inexpressible. Like, I see the white wall, but there is my real intuitive perception of it doesn't see it as, quote, white. The judgment that it is, quote, white, brings in the element of inference, conceptualization, my previous experience of what white is, a recognition of that, and therefore distorts it, actually, by making it fit into a category of mine. It doesn't see it in all of its ineffable ungraspability, in a way, even though I'm encountering, like, touching it, I'm seeing it, and my mind contacts it without being able to subsume it into a conceptual category. So this now builds on, remember the five aggregates, we've run into that everywhere, and I hope you now by now know what they are, which is matter, actually I may have still used form in this translation, which is no good, matter, sensation, pleasure, pain, neutrality, recognition, or samjha. Sometimes people call it perception. So just the root nya to know, and sam means taking together. So samjha means knowing by taking together something, so recognizing something. So it has a conceptual, and it fits with verbalization, you know. And then samskara, mental functions, you know, reactions, emotions, and ideas of time and space and all kinds of structure in the mind. samskaras, and then finally vijnana, which is just pure awareness. So there was this contradiction or contrast in even in the aggregate system, which is just heuristic, of course. But even in that system, there was a contrast between vijnana, which is just awareness, and samjna, you know, because vid means to divide, vijna, just to know sort of subjectively and objectively, like to know something, but not really what it is. Samjna then means you recognize it for something. So there was a thing of the conceptual awareness plus the non-conceptual awareness in the original aggregate system. So he builds on that, like a real scientist, actually, a mind scientist, Dignaga does. You know, contradicting a lot of the other Indian logicians and philosophers that he's dealing with in the 6th century, who are beginning to, you know, emerge, you know, that kind of debate between the Buddhists and the Nyaya Vaisheshikas and things. It's kind of beginning. It took centuries for it to develop because the Buddhists had the universities and the Nyayas didn't really fight with them, but then they do. And in that, he gets to this idea that you find in this sutra, although he does it in a way where it doesn't have to be automatically put into an idealist thing, of where all that we cognize through our concepts is some way distorted. It is falsified by us fitting it into some grid of recognized, of things that we can recognize, of preconceived ideas. And so when we can break free of the idea being that when we break free of that superimposition of conceptualization on our experience, we have a kind of inchoate but real experience of the world. So, because we're in direct contact with it. It's a really very clever and wonderful thing. He does not now, of course, in the logic, so therefore, he says, all theories, therefore, in a way, are falsifying themselves. They're never adequate to reality, which is inexpressible. However, we need them to unwind our being trapped in our conceptualization. Having a screen between us and experience, pure experience, of like making, you know, cramming that experience into our preconceived ideas, into our routinized recognitional patterns. Do you follow me? You know, that this connects a little bit with the Worf-Saper hypothesis, you know, that cultures can only perceive what they have terms for things to perceive, which some people feel is extreme, but is really there. I remember very much a wonderful book that I like called Wizard of the Upper Amazon, about a guy who was captured by some Amazon natives, a Peruvian guy, an Ecuadorian guy who was captured at the age of 16 or 17 by these natives, who killed his uncle and aunt where he was living on a rubber plantation in the jungle, but kept him alive, seeking to reacculturate him and make him a member of their tribe. And actually the medicine man of the tribe, you know, the chief shaman guy, wanted to make him his heir, because he felt since he was Ecuadorian, he could mediate for the tribe because the Ecuadorians were moving into their area. You know. And then when he first went back with them after the raid and the horrible murders and everything, he was all shook up. But anyway, he had to run back with them as a captive. And by the time he got back, all of his clothes had been torn off his body, and he had welts and cuts and slashes everywhere from the leaves and the vegetation. Whereas the people he was with, they ran right through it all without a tiny, when they were naked, and they just slipped right through it without a tiny scratch. Because he just perceived like walls of green things, but they saw all these sophisticated things and they could just swirl through them at high speed. And he just got all torn up with that. that's like an illustration of him not having to. It's like the Eskimos have like 45 words for snow or something. You know, that's a famous example. And we just see snow, you know, some white stuff. So this is very, very fruitful. Usually in this course, or I usually try to, but it gets to be too much cramming too many things in, but I get people to read a little bit of this Buddhist logic, because there, although he sort of has a, it's like at the beginning of his whole theory of logic and reasoning, and then he has inference for yourself, which is reasoning in your own mind, and then inference for another, which is a syllogism, which is formal argument. And then he sets forth the formal syllogism. And so you, in a way, you really kind of have to know this to later appreciate the Svatantrikas and the Prasangikas, you know, the dogmaticist and the dialecticist difference, which we'll get to, which is even more interesting later in the book. And we already looked at a version of it in the introduction. And, Baba Viveka sort of fits with the logicians, and he wants to put forth the syllogism. And the Buddhist syllogism is actually more scientific and less sort of metaphysical, disconnected than the Greek one, because the Buddhist syllogism, which becomes the Indian syllogism, has to have an example as part of the syllogism. So in other words, if you say, I see smoke, your hypothesis, there is fire on the mountain because I see smoke. Wherever there is smoke, there is fire. That would be like the Greek syllogism. But the Buddhist one has to add, as in a kitchen. I mean, because in kitchens they made fires with twigs, in ancient Indian kitchens. They didn't have like electric burners. Or, some place where you have an actual instance of smoke and fire occurring together. You have to have that example. And then actually, full form of the syllogism, you have to have a counterexample as some place where there is no smoke and no fire. You have to use something like in a lake, where there's no smoke and no fire. So that this is to ensure that what you argue about comes back to experienced reality and isn't just some like fairy tale thing that has no bearing on reality. That's an interesting point about it, which then because the Buddhists create in a way Indian logic, more or less. I mean, a little bit in the law courts the Brahmins have, but the Buddhists really refine it. And this keeps it very pragmatist, in fact, Buddhist philosophy, Buddhist logic and philosophy. Okay? So now we come to this issue of the... So coming back to this, based on that idea, so the idea is, the yoga of all this is, of the idealist is, to break free, to understand actually, one of the great contributions of Asanga Vasubandhu, the Sandinamochana Sutra, is to begin to understand how conceptualization, this notion of ascriptive and descriptive designation, how language functions. Because, for example, in Dignaga's theory, he says, he says to the Indian materialist or the Indian physicist, he says, you have categories like substance, quality, motion, right, the classical thing. But there's no such things as those in reality, he says. What there are nouns, adjectives, and verbs. And based on the grammar of your mind, with its nouns and its adjectives and its verbs, to correspond to the nouns, you have substance. To correspond to the adjectives, you have qualities. To correspond to the activities, you have, to the verbs, you have action and motion. Do you follow me? And so he has this idea. And then finally he has another thing that is very interesting too. He says that, and also the way the judgment of the conceptual mind works is differential. Meaning that when you pick out the bottle here, like when I first open my eye and look here, there's like an undifferentiated mass of things, and I immediately start picking out the bottle, the book, the table surface, the computer, the person, the face, the window, the ceiling. I completely structure it into all kinds of things that I recognize. If there's something I don't recognize, I get really hung up about it until I sort of recognize it. I can find some place to control it. It seems to me, by categorizing and recognizing what I perceive. But what he's saying is it's differential. That is to say, what the bottle actually is the non-non-bottle. In other words, I pick it out from all that I exclude. So that in fact, and this is very important, this is the way that they reject like Platonic type of idea. The idea that what you see when you see the bottle is the abstract concept or the general concept of bottleness, the form, the Platonic form instantiated in the bottle. So that in a way that universals, general characteristics or universal characteristics are more real than the individual object. This is the kind of conceptualism that you have find in Plato. And he, to undo that, and the Indian philosophers have that, a lot of the Indian philosophers have that kind of idea, and to undo that, Dignaga says, no, there's no sort of absolute concept of a bottle, really. But what you do is you pick something out from the background, and then you say, that's the bottle. But actually, what it really is a non-non-bottle. And this then makes the distortion involved in conceptualizing your environment and your experience more apparent. It's called apoha. It's like this negational or differential theory of meaning. It's very fascinating, actually. It's just in its own right. But here, we're only using it a little bit to build up to things, because there is that argument about the conceptual differential versus the ground differential that we will look at, that I'm sure flummoxed a lot of you, or should have. Nobody actually mentioned it in their writing. They were flummoxed by other things, but it's horribly flummoxing, trust me. It is. Okay, so now what the Vijnanavada thing is doing, therefore, in its three nature theory, or three unreality theory, whatever you want to call it, is it is providing the practitioner, the yogin, the sign, which means the scientist, means the one who is yoking themselves to their experience, to the reality of their experience. You know, in a way, a yogi is a scientist, actually. You know, we think, what do we think a yogi is? Someone who goes and puts on some tights and does some postures. But even the Yoga Sutra, there's like one half of one verse about the asanas, the postures. It's not important. Although it's healthy and it's good to do yoga, but it ends up there's a great physiological science from India underlying it. But what yogi really means is yoking, it's the word yoke, same Indo-European word, yoking your mind to reality. That's actually how yoga is sort of etymologized in the tradition. And so a scientist is a yogin, in the sense that they are not just taking for granted what they see. They are investigating it with machinery and with this and that, analysis, with theory, with mathematics, and they are really pressing on it, pushing into it, yoking themselves to find out what is the reality of it. And experiment and experiential, that's why in a way, Yogacara, I translate as experientialist, one who frameworks experience as the contact with reality, recognizing that we normally don't have pure experience. We shut ourselves off from experience by fitting everything into some preconceived ideas that we have. You know, it's like you go to the museum and you see something, but then really you look at the label right away, you know, or pretty soon, you know, you kind of see it for a minute, but then instead of really like just letting it carry you or something, you quickly identify it. And then the minute you do, then the aesthetic experience is pretty much over. Because, oh yeah, Van Gogh, right, or what, they paid $30 million for that one, blah, blah, blah. For old Van Gogh, he got 30 francs. He was lucky. Because we live in this world where we're talking to ourselves all the time. We're constantly reinforcing refreshing the screen of our preconceived idea that the world fits with our preconceived idea of the world. So naturally, nothing is really very interesting or surprising because we already know what's going to happen, in a way. Although we seek thrills and things to get away from that, but the mind immediately clamps down. Anyway, so that's what it is here. So therefore, it's pretty simple, really, although there's all these kind of technical terms, identity, unreality, and this issue of intrinsic identity is very, very important. The word salakshana is a very important word. And there is another footnote I don't need a footnote, and it has three major zones of meaning. I think I do mention. And at its lowest, laksh means to mark something. And so lakshana means, therefore, a kind of marking of something, and therefore a characteristic mark of something. And in its lowest level of meaning in the Abhidharma, you could say in the Buddhist context, lakshana means the defining characteristic of something, of an object, right? Like the bottle holds water or something, that's its lakshana. Then in this logic system, so lakshana is opposed to samanya lakshana, which means a general characteristic as a particular characteristic, and therefore it comes to mean particularity. And the particularity of things is where we intuitively experience them, but it's unique. It's just the particularity. And we don't really have, it doesn't fit into our general characteristic. And it's as if, you know, which we have sometimes. Sometimes you have moments like that. You wake up or you see something and you don't recognize it all right away. And so it doesn't fit into some concept that you can recognize. And then you find one though quickly. And then when you do, you fit it into a general category. And but that the svalakshana is what you encounter when you don't recognize it, actually. But you know you're encountering something, but you don't recognize what you're encountering. And in a way, actually, you don't even, from Dignaga's more radical point of view, why is your perception of it realistic when you first encounter it? When you first encounter it, you're in it. You're not really retreated to yourself and like looking out and picking it out. It's something outside yourself. That is, subject-object dichotomy is not being imported yet, in a way. And this is very interesting. Like in the form, in the material aggregate, okay, the rupa skanda, right, within the five aggregate system. This is very interesting. Which is just a heuristic thing, right, that you use when you're looking for the self. It's your body-mind complex, so it's your body, sort of thing. And we think of our body as like some wetware in here and a bunch of stuff. And inside the skin or something like that. That's the body. And but in the material aggregate is not only that. It is all of that. But also, it's all our sense fields. So that means that my material aggregate now includes whatever I'm seeing, whatever I'm hearing, whatever I'm smelling, whatever I'm tasting, whatever I'm touching. And also things that, well, no, the mental objects, well, there's sort of a bridge in there of the mental thing, but so in other words, it's the senses and their objects are our material aggregate. So we are actually, even at that level of heuristic thing of examining yourself, we are sort of a field being, as you could say. So if you and I are looking at the same thing, in a way, we're looking at all looking at the wall, where our material aggregates are overlapping in some certain way. Because we're not just defined by the boundary of our skin. Like the boundary of our sense ranges is we're defined by. So when you have pure experience, when you see something, you know, like I see the church building over there, before I like structure it and like, okay, I seeing that, it's, you know, the photon bounced off, whatever theory I have about what seeing is, you know, and I'm here, and that's different from me, it's out there, and I know what it is, and I recognize it, and before that, when I'm just there, I'm somehow out the window. I'm out there on the wall, or in that window, you know, for a split second. Or in a way, underneath my recognizing all my busy brain activity and recognizing and mental activity and recognizing and classifying and structuring and so forth and noticing qualities, that's what's keeping me in contact there is, in a way, I'm out there, if you follow me. So that's why only a Buddha is there, lives in a realm of pure intuitive contact. Because that's paramartha satya, that's ultimate reality. It's what you, so he bridges, you know, he makes the logic brilliantly non-dual, that's what I'm saying. If you can get away from being trapped in your conceptual net, you are an enlightened experience. And therefore, for example, they sometimes say, some of the siddhas do, in sort of more, sort of very advanced in yoga things, they sort of say, well, in Zen, they say the miracle of enlightenment is the ordinary world. But what they mean by that is very different from our habitual ordinary world, where we never really get to the real ordinariness of the world, in the sense that we project our categories over it and we live in our categories. We live within a narrative. We talk ourselves through life. And we make sure not to, we're very threatened when something doesn't fit in what we preconceived or prejudged to know. And therefore people even have conflict. That's a so-and-so. No, it isn't. It's a so-and-so. And they freak out. If you're stoned or drunk or something, and you might hallucinate. Because you won't be recognizing what you're looking at. You're somehow, you drank so much of your vodka, paralyzed your conceptualization faculty. And it's just kind of a blur. And so then looks like a dragon or whatever. Somebody looks like somebody else. But you wouldn't hallucinate if you were a Buddha, because you would not be seeking to label something on it and control it by making it fit into your concept. You'd let it be itself in some way. Apparently. Anyway. Okay, so that's what this is. That's, I just wanted to get into that. Is that helpful? So this is what it's all about. All of this business about reification and non-reification and non-repudiation. You know, it's a way of talking about the middle way. And aside, you know, from the Prasangika point of view, now from the point of view of these Yogacharans, these experientialists, people who jump straight into the Madhyamaka thing are going beyond their ability, because they're going to come up with the concept of emptiness as if, and they're going to project their emptiness on everything, and they're going to annihilate everything, and they're going to think karma doesn't work, and they can just go crazy. They become nihilistic. So the Buddha taught, now the really sharper person, when they hear shunyata, they will realize relativity, and this will not be a problem for them. But a lot of people will be misled by shunyata into nihilism. And so to catch them, the Buddha teaches the third wheel of Dharma, which therefore is not the ultimate one. It's the ultimate one in his biography, but it's the one that he does to catch people who would misinterpret the more radical Prajnaparamita teaching. It's the Prajnaparamita idea, but the experientialist idea, the Yogacharan idea, or the Vijnanabhata idea, is that the Madhyamaka one becomes too nihilistic. And Dzogchenpa has been quite creative here, actually, and shocking a lot of the Tibetans when he says that a Sangha in the Bodhisattva stages, in the division of extremes, middle and extremes, in the compendium, in these different works of the Sanghas, based on the something of the elucidation of the intention, a Sangha is picking out the Madhyamaka as a nihilist. And he's saying, our Yogacara thing is the middle way, and you guys are just too nihilistic. Just say something superficially there, like that's no good.
Weekly interstitial music provided by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, please visit tibethouse.us. Study Buddhism up close and personal with Robert Thurman during one of his intensive programs at Menla Retreat in Phoenicia, New York, or during one of the Tibet House U.S. member trips with Geographic Expeditions in 2018. Trips this year include Mongolia and Bhutan. To learn more about these member trips, please visit bobthurman.com. Thanks for tuning in, and Tashi Dilek.